This is Angela Ewing with KCIW, Curry Coast Community Radio, with Storytime, 9 O'Clock Horses, Episode 10. When we returned to England after the fortnight in Portugal, Colin sat night after night working on his resume, or curriculum vitae, as we call it in UK. He had credentials to show and was sure now that he was heading for a better life in the States. Suddenly everything was wrong with England, in his book. There was nothing to look forward to with the Labour government and the trade unions sticking their noses in everywhere. They had nationalised the coal, rail and docks industries. Colin was incensed about that. I had my own worries. I needed a job. A week later, I was lucky to find employment with the Wycliffe Brokerage Company, who agreed to hire me at a little higher salary than I was used to. It was a plush establishment on a quiet side street near the centre of town. Although I didn't have my own office, I liked the atmosphere among the other secretaries. I began to learn the vocabulary associated with stocks and bonds and stock market lingo. It was exciting to discover a different mentality around me. My parents had never discussed money or the value of it, other than the fact they never seemed to have quite enough. Here at this office, words like dividends and profit margins and annuities crept into everyday conversation. It was several weeks before good news came from the States for Colin, who announced ecstatically that he had been accepted by Bell Telephone Company in New York, with the proviso that he produce a clean medical report and complete the necessary paperwork to obtain a green card. I began to catch his excitement. I had no doubt at this point that as soon as he was settled there, he would send for me. He could sponsor me. Desperate though I was to accompany Colin to the US, I knew being just a secretary was not good enough. America wanted scientists, engineers, doctors, skilled workers with degrees, not secretaries. Plenty of American girls for that. I decided to talk to my boss at the office to see if there was a chance of being transferred to an affiliate brokerage office in New York as a trained secretary in mutual funds. I was already familiar with the terms used in that department. I noticed the bosses were in contact with New York Stock Exchange every day. It seemed like a reasonable request. My superior, James Travers, was an astute businessman and a kindly soul. He was white-haired and gentle in his ways with me. I felt comfortable talking to him about Colin and my plans. He must have realized I was serious about emigrating because he said, "Their affiliate company on Broad Street, Lerner Hitchinson Corporation, was a member of the New York Stock Exchange, and yes, they had accepted secretaries from England in the past." Colin was excited when I told him about the conversation with Mr. Travers. "Oh, that would be great," he said. And once again, he voiced his opinion. "Let's face it, England's going to the dogs, going downhill. We've already lost most of our empire. In fact, Africa, where your sister went, is already getting their independence. America is the place to be." I was just as thrilled as Colin was, but it all seemed exhausting to face what we would have to go through to get there, and I wondered how my parents would take the news. One evening after work, I decided I had to tell them. "I'm thinking of going to live in the States," I announced as I sat back in the armchair. There was a stunned silence. My mother spoke first. "America? Why on earth would you want to go there?" "Well, because I think Colin and I could have a better life. A car, maybe, and a house of our own. It is the land of opportunity." She shook her head. "You do come up with some harebrained ideas. What about all the crime? Guns and such. Al Capone and his gangs." "Al Capone," I said. "For goodness sake, that was in the 30s. We're in the 60s now." "Well," she argued, "that mentality still exists there. Anyone can get a gun. Anyone. More people get murdered in America than anywhere else in the world. It's the Wild West. It still is. It crossed my mind that my mother had obviously dismissed the fact or forgotten that she had used a gun. When my father finally spoke, his tone was deliberate and final. I reckon if Amelia believes England is such a terrible place to live, she should go. I said, you didn't seem upset when Pauline left for England for Africa, and that's a third world country. My mother raised her eyebrows. Well, she had a husband, that's the difference. My father said, oh, you'll be all right. You can always come back if it doesn't work out. Although I agree, you should get a job first. That was typical of my father, always the pragmatist. Events for Colin happened quickly. He received a letter from Bell Telephone Company in the States arranging for him to get a medical exam. My boss suggested I go at the same time. Why not be ready, he said. You know we'll all do our best for you. I'm checking every day with the boys in New York. If they hire you, you're on your way. So it will happen. Colin and I took the train to London to the American consulate, the immigration department in Grosvenor Square, London. We were ushered into a small room, metal tables and chairs, no luxury here. Lots of papers with questions, boxes to check. Routine, we were told. Some of the questions seemed trite to me, quite unnecessary and meaningless. Why do you want to go to the United States of America to live? Do you have relatives who live in the USA? Do you intend to have a family? Will you be gainfully employed so that you will not become a ward of the state? Colin could answer yes to that one, but not me, not yet. One of the questions made me laugh. Do you intend to practice prostitution in the USA? I wondered what the response would be if I answered yes. After about 2 hours, we were summoned to another department to take our medical examinations. It was in a different building a few blocks away from the consulate. We found a place to have a quick lunch, and then the rest of the day was taken up by a thorough medical examination and more questions. I was glad they didn't ask me too many questions about employment opportunity. It seemed that one department didn't know what the other one had done or had not done. Anyway, it was primarily for Colin at this point. I could hardly set my mind to anything for the next 3 weeks when finally a letter arrived from the American consulate for Colin. The letterhead was embossed in gold. Colin had passed the medical. A report would be mailed to him forthwith, and it would be presented to the employer in the States along with the other necessary paperwork if it was done within 6 months of receipt of this letter. I joked with Colin, best not to get sick in 6 months, then I'll have to start all over again. I was finally light-hearted. I knew my report would be good, and now it would be up to my boss to set things in motion. I had no doubts now this would be the most exciting thing in my life ever, to be going to the USA to join the person I loved and be his wife. Finally, about 3 weeks later, the letter arrived. I tore open the envelope and began to read. The letter began with a thank you for considering the possibility of immigration to the United States of America. Then, after reading those first few lines, I almost passed out. We regret to advise you that because of a Class A medical condition, we must render you inadmissible to the United States of America. We recommend you seek a doctor's attention immediately. You can imagine what went through my mind at that moment. What the hell did that mean? It was so brief, so unexplained and frightening. I soon found out when I went to the doctor. I had tuberculosis. My sister's words literally poured into my brain. Over and over, I heard her voice. The air is terribly unhealthy. Patricia Fleming had TB, and her sister. I didn't know then what she was really talking about. I had attached little importance to it, except it was a dreadful illness from which people sometimes died. On that particular occasion at the doctor's office, I was glad my mother was with me. She actually took my hand and held it for a long time. I cried and let her console me as we waited for the doctor in the growing dusk in the waiting room. We had been there for hours with various tests and x-rays. Mother said, "I bet the doctor at the immigration office was from Pakistan." "National Health Service," she whispered. "You know, all our good doctors have gone. We should get a second opinion. That's what we'll do." "Mom," I said, trying not to blubber, "it's what the medical examiner found out on behalf of the American consulate, and he wasn't from India." Now I found myself consoling her. "It's all right, I'll be fine." To make things worse, I received a letter from my cousin Ellie. Her mother, my Aunt Dorothy, had died from a blood clot to the brain after her surgery a week ago. It was all so sudden. I had tea with her only 2 weeks ago. I remembered thinking how very thin she was, but no one suspected that she had breast cancer because she wouldn't talk about it. She had survived the surgery, apparently, and then a blood clot went to her brain and caused a massive stroke. I remembered how happy she was when I bought her a bunch of cowslips from Hadley's farm when I'd been with Colin. Now the realization that she would no longer be around for me to talk to or have a cup of tea depressed me more than my own predicament. That night, I dreamed I was sitting on one of the high stools in the greenhouse with the freesias. It was a brief dream, but when I woke up, I could smell the flowers. It was all so real. My mother was eager to explain. "Oh, it's all right. It was your Aunt Dorothy visiting you." "Mom, Aunt Dorothy is dead," I said, trying not to cry again. "Yes, but you will smell those flowers when her spirit visits you." I didn't believe her then, but I do now. Meanwhile, I had received instructions from our doctor arranging for me to go to the TB sanitarium in Brighton, on the south coast of England. Less than 2 weeks later, Colin and I sat on the wooden bench in the corner of Leicester's draughty railway station, waiting for the southbound train to Brighton. He had his arm around me. I laid my head on his shoulder. I could feel the rough surface of his tweed jacket against my cheek. "I don't feel sick," I said, "and I really don't know why I need to go to the sanitarium. It sounds like a terrible place. I bet the walls are old and ill, just like the walls at the mental hospital where my mother was." "You're not sick, lass," Colin said, stroking my hair and giving me a reassuring kiss on my forehead. He said, "The spot on your lung is small, as the doctor said. Tuberculosis is curable now with the new antibiotics. And," he added, "you'll get better faster at the sanitarium, I'm sure. From the photographs of the place, it looks as though it's really nice on the beach. 3 months will zip by and then you'll be well." Well, I wonder why they couldn't give me antibiotics at home. Forget the sanitarium or for some... I don't know. I said, "It's just not right." "Because Dr. Marks told you you need a lot of bed rest. I don't think you'd get that at home or with your Aunt Olive, do you?" "No, I suppose not." A voice echoed through the station from the loudspeakers. "The Brighton train leaves. 5 minutes. Platform 2. Platform 2. Brighton train. Platform 2. "That's ours," Colin said. "Come on." As the train pulled away from the station in a cloud of heavy smoke, Colin lifted my small suitcase onto the overhead rack. We had the small carriage to ourselves, and as the train picked up speed, I studied the landscape flashing by. It was all so peaceful out there, rows of small houses all close together, then a patchwork of fields, green and yellow, hedges separating fields of wheat, brown earth, and a tractor with a man on it in a blue shirt and a funny hat. Colin laid his arm across the back of the seat and smoothed my hair. "It's not going to be a bad thing putting our plans on hold for a while, you know," he said. "I'll be close by all the time you're in the sanitarium. I've decided to take a room in one of the boarding houses near the beach." "Brighton is a great place to visit in the winter." He winked and gave my hair a tug. "I can have a dirty weekend in Brighton." I couldn't manage a laugh, but I had to smile. It was not uncommon to hear someone say that they were going to have a dirty weekend in Brighton. The joke had begun in 1841, when the Prince of Wales was known to have taken his mistress there for weekends. Brighton is only a short train ride from London. "How can you stay in Brighton?" I asked. "You have to be ready to leave this time next month." "Oh, well, I'm not going to America without you. I've decided you need me here, and that's that. When you're better and your company gets transferred to New York, then we'll go." "Oh, no," I said as I pulled away from him. "That's not right. I won't let you miss this opportunity to work for Bell Telephone, Colin. That would be silly." Colin didn't answer, and we both sat there listening to the rhythm of the train on the tracks and the different sound it made as it went through the tunnels. He was obviously deep in thought, as I was. Finally, Colin sighed. He looked at me and took both my hands in his. "Look," he said, "there's another reason why I'm going to wait for you. Now listen carefully to what I'm telling you, all right?" I looked at him. "What is it? You pass the medical. You've got a visa. You'll have a green card when you get to New York, so what's wrong?" "Here is the problem," he said slowly. "When I signed those papers to get my status as a legal resident alien, there was a clause that I had to agree to." He let go of my hands to turn my face to his. "Look at me and listen. As a legal registered alien with a green card, I would be eligible for military service. Do you understand that?"
"How could you be, Colin? You're not a citizen. How could they draft you into the military? You're an alien, see?"
I stuck my fingers up above my head. "A-L-I-E-N. Colin turned away to stare out the window. "I know you don't listen to the news, but you do know that America is on the verge of helping Vietnam, don't you?" I didn't know that, because I didn't listen to the news.
"But you're not in America. And just because America is thinking of helping out another country doesn't mean much, does it? You couldn't be affected that way."
I could feel myself talking, chatting away, trying to blot out whatever he was going to say to me. "Amelia, it doesn't matter. If I have a green card, I will be drafted into service if they need me. Capisce?" Colin had been to Italy a couple of times with his friends, and it seemed to be the word he used often when he was frustrated with me.
"I want you to go to America, Colin," I pleaded. "Please don't miss this opportunity to work for a great company in something you're trained for, okay?"
"Well, I'm asking you now if you are sure, if you really want me to go. The risk is that things will escalate in Vietnam. I'll have no choice but to go where and when I'm needed. I want to wait for you. I don't want to go without you." I thought for a minute.
"Well, what can happen to the job offer with Bell Telephone if you don't go now?"
"Well," he said, "I guess they'll hire someone else."
"There you are, you see," I said triumphantly, as though I had won the argument. "There you are. I don't want you to stay with me if that's true. Why miss this opportunity?"
"I suppose so."
"Well then, just go and risk that they don't call you up. Anyway, I can't imagine that there will be a war in Vietnam. Are troops really being sent over there? I think it could be over before you even get settled, don't you?"
"No," Colin said, more to the window than to me. "No, I don't think that will be the case at all."
This is the end of episode 10 of 9 O'Clock Horses. Please listen next week to episode 11.
Thank you for listening.
If you enjoyed this program and want to hear more like it, consider supporting Curry Coast Community Radio and help us get on the air. For more information, go to our website, kciw.org. Thank you for listening.